The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Friends of Community Radio, Asheville FM, any of the affiliate stations, or even the producers of the Final Straw Radio. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, and Berkeley Liberation Radio in Berkeley, California. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with anything you want. And you can send us snail mail at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. This week's show features a conversation with Ori Lumumba. Ori is involved in the MOVE organization and the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We speak about the upcoming push to parole Debbie Sims Africa, Janet Holloway Africa, and Janine Africa, the three remaining women of the MOVE 9. The MOVE 9 were nine members of the MOVE organization whose house was raided in Philadelphia in 1978 after escalating conflicts with the Philadelphia Police Department and then Mayor Frank Rizzo. The nine were convicted of the death of Officer James Ramp during the raid, while the supporters and members of the MOVE 9 argue the nine had no part in it, that the shot was actually fired by the police department mistakenly from behind. This is one of the many instances the MOVE organization was repressed in Philadelphia during the 1970s and 80s. The MOVE organization is a religious, vegan, black liberation organization focused around social justice issues and bases its philosophies on the teachings of John Africa. In February, at the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Educational Center, there will be, in New York City, there will be a rally around the parole push for the nine. There's also an online petition for the push for the parole for the three members of the MOVE 9. More information on the struggle can be found at onamove.org, and more on the parole push can be found at move9parole.blogspot.com. The second half of the conversation concerns the upcoming parole push for Herman Bell. Herman Bell was a member of the Black Panther Party and later a soldier with the Black Liberation Army who, with Albert New Washington and Julian Muntakin, was convicted of the death of two New York police officers, Waverly Jones and Joseph A. Piacentini, in 1971. More on support for Herman Bell can be found at freehermanbell.org. We talk briefly about police violence against black people in the United States in the 1960s and 70s and again today in relation to the development of black liberation struggles and the current Black Lives Matter movements. The podcast version of this episode to be aired at the beginning of next week's radios, or a full podcast version of this episode, if you find it online, that has Ori speaking about medical issues faced by Mumia Abu-Jamal in the state of Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther and is a journalist who was given a death penalty sentence for the shooting death of Philly PD officer David Faulkner in 1981 during a traffic stop. Mumia and his supporters have always held to his innocence in the death of the officer. Mumia is now involved in a lawsuit, Abu-Jamal versus Carestes, to address the lack of treatment by the state's Department of Corrections of Mumia alongside the roughly 10,000 prisoners in the Pennsylvania prison system who are suffering from hepatitis C when an effective treatment is available. More on Mumia, his case, and his health can be found at freemumia.com. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
Since the attacks in Paris, which killed fewer than four other attacks that same week, but they weren't white, they don't count, the FBI has stepped up its surveillance over possible threats here in the United States. I saw on the corporate news brought to us by Disney, a corporation named after a guy who supported Hitler, that the FBI currently has 90 people in the United States under constant watch. When I saw that, I thought that was just another tidbit of propaganda, you know, just some random fictional factoid to make people feel relatively safe and extremely endangered all at the same time. I didn't think the FBI was really keeping people under constant watch. And then I woke up this morning and I found this stranger in my cell sitting at the desk. He was wearing a shirt and tie and had his sport coat draped over the back of the plastic chair he was sitting in. I noted that he had helped himself to a cup of my coffee. At first, I thought, maybe this guy was my Secret Service protection since I'm running for president. But no, he's the FBI agent assigned to me. He told me to act like he wasn't there, but he was staring at me as I attempted to use the toilet, and I really can't use the toilet under pressure. The agent suggested that I run the sink water, and that worked. So I guess that proves that this guy has a lot of experience creeping people out and staring at them while they p***. Your tax dollars at work, sports fans. He followed me to the chow hall at breakfast and stared at me from the next table as I ate my scrambled eggs. He took notes on a flip-open notebook he keeps in his shirt pocket. Nobody wanted to sit with me at breakfast. Go figure. So from there, I went over to the library. Dude followed me around as I handed other prisoners books. At count time, when I returned to my cell, I read something that friends sent me proposing Black December. As I read, the FBI agent used my remote and flipped through the channels in my TV and spent the time watching Jerry Springer. From what I gather, the scenario was that some guy was cheating on the mother of his child with an exotic dancer. The mother of his child and the exotic dancer fought each other, and then the mother of his child forgave him and took him back. The FBI agent sure drinks a lot of coffee. I can't really afford this. At shift change, another agent took over. The second agent spends most of his shift talking on the phone with his girlfriend, his feet propped up on my locker box, yet holes in his socks. Apparently, the FBI doesn't pay like it used to. I wonder if the other 89 people on the watch list are having similar experiences. I sure hope the Islamic State stops killing white people so this nonsense can die down and I can get rid of this intense surveillance. The second shift agent's feet stink up my cell. So, just before the grand finale of Dancing with the Stars, the third shift agent came on. He's an older guy. He was rooting for Nick, the former Backstreet Boy, and I was rooting for Bindi, the daughter of that Australian wilderness guy who got killed by a stingray. The agent clearly didn't know his ballroom dance. I had to explain the difference between Argentine tango and the paso doble. I showed him a few things. His frame was sloppy. I had to leave. Where are they finding these agents? Anyhow, the guy was chain smoking while I tried to sleep, and I had to leave my cell window open to get rid of the smoke. So, look, I have no privacy at all. These wackos even watch me in the shower while I take a while I sleep. It appears this intense surveillance is going to continue throughout the holidays, or maybe even longer if the Islamic State continues to kill white people on the European continent. Anyhow, just so you know, when the FBI says they're closely monitoring 90 of the most serious threats to national security, they're not kidding. And yet, I'm still sneaking out my radio segments through the mail. Go figure. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the Ohio torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
We're speaking with Ori Lumumba. Ori was kind enough to come onto The Final Straw in early 2014 to talk about the push to get parole for members of the Move 9. Welcome back, Mr. Lumumba, and thanks for all that you do.
On the move, brother, and thank you for having me. It's greatly appreciated. How are you tonight?
I'm pretty well. How about you?
Good, good. No complaints. Thank you.
Good to hear.
Just out here doing what we do, just fighting the system, fighting for freedom.
I hear that. This week, we'll be speaking with Ori about the upcoming push to get Debbie Sims, Janet Holloway Africa, and Janine Phillips Africa paroled after serving 38 years as a part of the Move 9 case. And we'll be speaking about the parole push for Herman Bell later, a former Black Panther convicted of participation in the death of two New York Police Department members in a Black Liberation Army-related attack in 1971. But getting back to the Move 9, for those listeners who don't know about their case or Move in general, can you explain who Move is and what happened in 1978?
Well, the Move 9 are a group of men and women of the Move organization that was arrested on August 8, 1978 and framed for the murder of Philadelphia police officer James Wren. MOVE is a totally revolutionary organization founded in the Above Ground chapter in the early 70s in Philadelphia which is founded by John Africa, a very wise and strategic black man who was the founder and coordinator of the MOVE organization. And the work that MOVE is doing is to stop this system from imposing on life, from polluting the air, to polluting the water, to polluting the soil, the very things that we need to survive. You know, people, I had to talk about the fight against mass incarceration or freeing the wrongfully convicted or freeing political prisoners. Not only is MOVE doing that work, but MOVE is doing work to end the reality, to end the zoo, because the zoo is prison to animals. This is some of the work that MOVE was doing in the 70s, demonstrating against the zoo, demonstrating against the circus, against these nursing homes where senior citizens were being abused, having their checks stolen by the staff, you know. And this stuff wasn't seen as trendy, wasn't seen as fashionable. So a MOVE would picket at these places and have demonstrations, you know, the police would be called. And, of course, the police would side with the owners of these institutions, which led to conflict between the police and MOVE, in which MOVE members were beaten, MOVE members was arrested, and which just culminated with a 7-month pregnant MOVE woman being kicked in her vagina in a police precinct, forcing her to miscarry, or another pregnant MOVE woman being beaten into a miscarriage in a courthouse where the baby came out in black and blue bruises, or to our sister Janine Africa and her late husband Phil Africa, 3-week-old baby being stomped to death. And this is the type of brutality used against the MOVE organization, which caused MOVE to take a stand, a year-long stand, which led to a standoff between the city and MOVE, which started on May 20th, 1977, and lasted for an entire year, where a starvation blockade was put up against the house of the MOVE organization, where no food or water was let in. And to say this is, I'm just giving a rundown of this because this is what culminated and led up to August 8th, 1978. There was an alleged agreement between MOVE and the city of Philadelphia for MOVE to eventually leave their Powhatan Village headquarters. That was a lie. MOVE never agreed to leave their headquarters. And this led to a contempt of court, which led to an eviction order being filed against MOVE. On the wee hours of August 8, 1978, Philadelphia police came out to MOVE headquarters to evict MOVE. The point we want to make is, whenever in the history of an eviction has over 500 cops come out to evict you with guns, with tanks, you know, with cherry cranes and bulldozers, you know, police came out telling MOVE to leave, but would you come out of your house with its 500 cops with guns waiting to kill you? So MOVE people did the logical thing and retreated to the basement of their house. And, you know, police flooded the basement with water, police and the fire department, where women that were 4'11", you know, they had to be held up by the men so that they wouldn't drown. Children had to be held up. You know, police fired tear gas into a basement, into a flooded basement. Somewhere along the frenzy, and it's documented in court reports, there was a neighbor down the street that fired a shot at the MOVE house, which then led to police firing over thousands of rounds of ammunition into that basement, shooting men, you know, shooting Delbert Africa, shooting Eddie Africa, you know. Cops testified they emptied their carbine at women and children screaming in the basement. In the frenzy after the shooting, when MOVE people started coming out the house, they were immediately arrested, beaten, like in the case of brother Delbert Africa, whose beating was caught on camera for the whole world to see. Our brother Delbert was beaten that day damn near to death, you know. They beat the men in their scrotums with slapjacks. They put our sisters in a van, took them somewhere by a waterfront, and we believe they tried to push the police van into the water so that our sisters can drown. Later, we found out our family was charged with the murder of a police officer named James Ramp. And this led to their arrest, their trial, and 38 years later today, their imprisonment. They were all given 30 to 100 years each for the murder of Officer James Ramp, who was shot in the back of his neck with the bullet traveling downwards. It is physically impossible for those people to all have put their hand on that gun and shoot James Ramp. They were 6 feet below street level. And you don't have to believe, people don't have to believe us. They can look no further than the late trial judge, Edwin Malmed, the day after sentencing moved people to 30 to 100 years. Malmed admitted on a radio show that he had the faintest idea who killed Officer James Rand. He said they acted as a family, so I'm sentencing them as a family, proving that they're not in prison for the crime of murder, but they're in prison for being committed MOVE members.
Can you talk about the operability of any guns that were on the property?
Here's an example. Like, during the trial, there was a video that the district attorney had that all of a sudden now is gone. When they had their PCRA appeals in the 90s, you know, this video footage allegedly turned up lost. The video, as it shows people coming out the house in the video footage, they show the police throwing guns through the windows of the basement, you know, passing guns in the house, you know. So this, now the weapons that was recovered, as they said the move had, they weren't even real weapons, or they were inoperable weapons that couldn't even be used. No one, especially the women and our brother Eddie Africa, none of them had weapons charges that day, or period. Now, there was an afternoon press conference that day at City Hall with the then district attorney, Ed Rendell, and the mayor, Frank Rizzo. They had all of the guns that was in the house displayed on the table, saying that these were the guns that came from the move house. They're uninterfered with. We took them from the basement. Now, one of the things we want to point out with the basement, that the basement, it wasn't a concrete basement. The basement had a dirt floor. So if you're in a basement that's being flooded with water, that dirt is going to turn into mud. So why weren't none of those so-called guns that they recovered from the basement, none of them was dirty and none of them had mud on it?
And there were witnesses, media witnesses in the outside who heard the shot come from up the street and away from the house, the shot that killed Officer Ramp, right?
Yes, Richard Maloney of KYW. He testified to it in court. And later that day, there was a man, I believe his name was Larry Manning, who lived down the street from MOVE, who was arrested for firing that shot. A couple of news reporters and neighbors testified to that first shot coming down the street from a neighbor's house. It came from 3300 Barron Street, one block down from 33rd and Powelton address of the MOVE organization.
Can you describe really briefly the sort of context, like political and racial context in the city in terms of the relationship between members of the MOVE organization and the police and Mayor Rizzo?
If you grew up in the Philadelphia in the 60s and the early 70s, especially in the Black and Latino community, you knew who Frank Rizzo was. Frank Rizzo was a former beat cop who worked his way up to police commissioner, who worked his way up to mayor on a platform of brutality. You know, back in the 60s, when, you know, high school students was protesting, one of them was Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know, to have Benjamin Franklin High School renamed Malcolm X High School. Here, Rizzo, as the police commissioner in that time, they was out there protesting. You know what Rizzo said to the cops? Get their black asses. You know, he said, I'm so tough, I'm going to make Attila the Hun look like a This man said, the Philadelphia Police Department is equipped to invade Cuba and win. This man and his police department has had a long-standing history of racism, of brutality against Black and Latino and poor citizens in Philadelphia throughout the 60s and the 70s. If you look at that infamous picture of members of the Black Panther Party in North Philly, where they were standing against the wall in their underwear, that's a result of Rizzo and his administration. You know, and it's been documented. Men, you know, having their teeth kicked out in police precincts. Women getting punched in their stomach to the point where it break their, they get a broken rib from it. You know, nightsticks getting cracked over people's heads in West Philadelphia, in Southwest Philadelphia, in North Philadelphia, led by Frank Rizzo, a beat cop who worked his way up to police commissioner, who worked his way up to mayor on a campaign of law and order and brutality.
I'd like to come back to Mumia Abu-Jamal and the Black Panther Party a little bit later in the conversation. But in the meantime, can you talk about, of the nine people convicted for the death of Officer Ramp, known collectively as Move 9, three of the women from the case are coming up for parole as of May of 2016, right?
Yes, our three sisters, Janet, Janine, and Debbie Africa, all have their parole hearings for May 2016.
And can you talk about their past parole pushes and the grounds for the prior denials by the parole board?
Oh, definitely. Well, since 2008, our family has become eligible for parole. And from 2008 up until this past summer, July 2015, they have all been denied by the parole board. And what it appears to be is just, this government, through the guise of the parole, Pennsylvania Parole Board, reinforcing their sentence for them to die in prison. You know, I want to just give an example of the women. They have all been recommended by their institution for parole and to be paroled by their institution. They have the superintendent, the warden, and their counselors all recommended them for parole. At least 99.9% of inmates in Pennsylvania, when they're recommended for parole by their institution, they get paroled. Not in the case of Move. You know, our brother Delbert Africa, our brother Mike Africa, both was recommended by their institutions for parole. Our late brother Phil Africa was recommended for his institution by parole, for parole. Okay? And none of them have been paroled by the parole board. The parole board systematically has come with every excuse, a common excuse that we see amongst political prisoners who are dealing with the parole process, where they get denied due to the nature of the crime, due to the fact that they will not show remorse or admit guilt. That was the first excuse. And we want to make one thing clear. Our family is innocent, and that's the position we have taken. And they have taken. They're not going to admit guilt for something that they did not do. They shouldn't have to. Okay, that's the first issue. The issue of the nature of the crime never changes. They've made every excuse saying that they're a risk to the safety of the community. You know, what community? No one from the parole board has interviewed members of the community and said, do y'all want these Move members back into your community? Are they talking about the law enforcement community? Which brings me to the next issue, because their parole hearings has been a complete conflict of interest. The fact that you have former cops like Lloyd White or Ramsey Feathers who sat over their parole hearings, it's a complete conflict of interest to have former cops sitting over a parole hearing of a case that revolves around a murder of a cop. And to show you how much further this goes, the late Lloyd White, a former cop who was the chairman of the parole board, sat over one of Eddie Africa's hearings and said to Eddie, you know, I was one of the officers on the scene that day on August 8, 1978. A complete conflict of interest right there. The fact that Leslie Gray, if you go on the Pennsylvania Parole Board's website, they have the bios of all of the parole officers. Leslie Gray has strong ties, not in our words, but in their words, strong ties to law enforcement officials across the state of Pennsylvania. The new chairman of the Pennsylvania Parole Board, Michael L. Green, who was appointed to the board over 10 years ago by Ed Rendell, the then governor of Pennsylvania. Ed Rendell was the district attorney of Philadelphia. His office prosecuted the Move 9 during their trial, okay? So having this man who was appointed by the former DA who prosecuted them is a clear conflict of interest. So this is what we're dealing with, the issue of the relationship between law enforcement and the parole board and past political alliances, all working together to keep our family in prison. They're saying that they haven't demonstrated no motivation for parole. These are men and women that's kept down gang violence in prisons, kept down racial violence, helped fathers reestablish relationships with their children, mothers reestablish relationships with their children. Not only counsel and help the inmates, but counsel and help staff members too, like guards who is brutalizing their wives at home after they finish brutalizing inmates. New people put an end to that. You know, help several guards fix their marriages, all through Move's belief, through the teachings of John Africa. You know, have helped men and women of current leaving prison get their lives together. And you're going to say they have no motivation for release, for parole? It's a lie. They're being kept in these prisons and not parole because they are committed Move members.
And that's a criminalized act. Outside of the inability of the state to break them is what is, or break them of their critique of how society is run and the place that they're shoved into is why they're being denied parole.
Exactly. Exactly. The goal of this system is to stop Move. They want to put an end to Move. That's what May 13th, 1985 was about. That's what August 8th, 1978 is about. They're not stopping us. They could come with guns, tanks, tear gas. You know, they dropped a bomb on our family on May 13th, 1985. And we hurt by that. We grieve for the loss of our family. But they're not stopping us. All that hurt, all that pain, we turn into energy to keep coming at this system. You know, we do. Go ahead, bro.
Oh, it's okay. You're on a roll. On a move. Yeah. But the anniversary of that came up this year, of the 1985 bombing, and it was, I don't know, remembered or publicly engaged with in Philly and in a couple of other parts of the country. I think Minneapolis had an event around it. And can you speak to how that event went?
Oh, the event was excellent. We must have had at least close to 1,000 people marching through the streets of Philadelphia, which started on 62nd and Osage Avenue in West Philadelphia, where the bombing occurred. You know, we sat there, and the children, you know, the babies of this organization were out there demonstrating, putting out information about what happened May 13th, 1985. You know, demonstrating and protesting for the release of their innocent family. And we had people from Chicago, people from Washington, people from Atlanta, people from the West Coast, New York, Delaware, Baltimore, Jersey, all came out that day. You know, we have former political prisoners like Lynn Stewart, Marshal Eddie Conway, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., all who came out. And to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Move bombing, the outright murder of men, women, and children by this system and its officials, and to also keep the pressure on these officials about the release of the Move 9. So it was a real good event, real good commemoration, real successful event, everything and stuff.
That's
people
good.
Left feeling good and committed to keep working and stuff.
That's good. That's really good. So of the original Move 9, two members have since passed since their incarceration, Merle Austin Africa and William Phil Africa. Can you talk generally about the circumstances of their death and deaths and what impact those deaths have on the push to get these three Move women out?
Well, what happened is our sister Merle Africa, there was a stomach virus going around SCI Cambridge Springs in March of 98. And Merle was one of the people affected by the stomach virus, but she was getting better. Like, the family just saw her on a visit prior to her passing, and she was doing a lot better. Like, she was eating crackers, oatmeal, everything, getting her strength back. So one morning, she was getting ready to leave to go to, you know, her prison-assigned job and stuff. And the matron and the nurses approached her and said, sorry, but you're not going nowhere. They forced her in what's called the lay-in, where you're forced to stay in your cell and where the food is brought to you. And when they brought the food into her, they mysteriously said to her, you know you're dying, right? Merle was like, huh? Later on in the middle of that night, you know, Merle was getting up to use the bathroom about 2 or 3 in the morning. And here she just passes out in her cell. She just passes out. So, you know, our sister Debbie called for help. And it took, now the hospital is only 45 minutes down the street. Not even less than 45 minutes. It's 15 minutes down the street. It took an ambulance 45 minutes to come. By then, our sister Merle passed. We don't know what happened exactly, but Merle was in those people's care. And they were responsible for her. There was all type of speculation. She had cancer. She had blood clots. People could believe what they want. But the point is this. When Merle Africa was arrested on August 8, 1978, she was a healthy woman. She was a healthy woman. And as he said, people can believe whatever they want. They can go by what the prison said and what the prison speculate. But they did something to our sister. They outright killed her. There is nothing innocent about being innocent and in prison for the last 20 years of your life. Nothing at all. That's the first thing. In regards to our brother, Phil Africa, last year around this time, you know, Phil developed a minor stomach bug. It was bothering him for a couple of weeks. He wasn't feeling that good, but he maintained. You know, he kept, you know, doing what he had to do. He maintained. And, you know, the family, we kept hearing about this stomach virus. He said he was going to the infirmary and stuff. So the family said, you know, MOVE members said, we're going to come up to visit you in Delbert, Africa tomorrow because they're together at the same prison. And upon MOVE people coming up, two of our brothers were on Delbert's visiting list. So they pulled out Delbert. And our other two brothers, they refused to let them in the prison to see Phil. So as they waited in the parking lot, our other two brothers went in to visit Delbert, Africa. And upon them leaving, you know, Delbert was looking for Phil. During the visit, prison officials secretly had Phil taken out of the hospital to an outside hospital. And for a period of 4 days from there, we were incommunicado. We were waged in a war with prison officials about the status and the whereabouts, the well-being of our brother Phil Africa. You know, they ran this thing about HIPAA regulation laws and a C-8 form where only a family member could get information about them. You know, we was in waged in a war with the Department of Corrections, with SCI Dallas, with the outside hospital about the well-being of our brother Phil Africa. At first, they said only his wife could speak to him. Now, his wife, Janine Africa, wanted to move nine, put in the paperwork to speak to him. And then it's like, well, it has to be a blood family member. Janine has been Phil's wife of 44 years, okay? We had to fight for her to be able to talk to him. So the Thursday, after being away for 4 days, she was finally able to speak to him. When he was incoherent, he couldn't, you know, hold the phone. We didn't know what was what. But all we knew the next day, he was transferred back to the prison in SCI Dallas, where he was sent back to the infirmary and immediately put in hospice care. So the warden gave special permission for our sister Ramona Africa and our brother Carlos Africa to come into the infirmary to visit him the next day. The night before, you know, our brother Delbert Africa went to the infirmary. He went to see Phil. He spent some time. He read to him, talked to him. And which was strange, because I'm going to get into that point. But the next day, you know, Ramona and Carlos, they did go up to visit Phil. And they sat with him for the infirmary for a while. He was kind of coherent, but still heavily drugged. So they gave him hugs. They left. About an hour later, as they're en route to home, we get a phone call that Phil passed away in the infirmary. And the circumstances about is this. He had a minor stomach bug. Even when he went to the infirmary, people that saw him, he was doing jumping jacks in the infirmary. He was talking to people, laughing, joking around. He was in good health, and he was fine. That's when he left. When he came back, he was in hospice care. We don't know what happened those 4 days in that outside hospital, but we know one thing for sure. Those people in the hospital and at the prison, they conspired to murder our brother Phil Africa. Again, Phil was a healthy man when he was arrested on August 8, 1978. He was a healthy man. The 36 years he spent in prison, he was under their care, under their diet, under their regulations. All right? They did something to our brother Phil Africa the same way they did something to our sister Merle Africa. And you ask, well, the implications this has. This hurts. This hurts. But it's given us more motivation, more ammunition to keep fighting this rotten, corrupt system and keep resisting it. You know, this intensifies our fight to bring our family members home, bottom line.
What kind of strategies are supporters employing in this new push for the three Move 9 women, and how can listeners help in this push to get them paroled?
Oh, definitely. Right now, we're finished formalizing the campaign, which will start effective January 1st. People can go to www.onamove.org, or they can also go to our Facebook page. You can go to Facebook and type in Justice for the Move 9. Again, that's Justice for the Move 9, and we're on Facebook. We've implemented certain things, like starting in January, we're doing Move 9 Media Month, 25 radio shows across the country to expose the parole board and the upcoming parole hearings for our sisters. We're doing a major public rally in New York in February at the Malcolm X Betty Shabazz Educational Center. That's going to feature people like Amina Baraka, Cornel West, several rappers, different other people. Women's History Month, we have several programs going on. We have in April an international petition that we're releasing from our international supporters demanding parole for our sisters. We have a commercial coming out to promote their parole hearings. And also at this time, we're requesting a meeting with the governor of Pennsylvania. Now, the governor has been citing errors in the parole board and requesting, you know, he's been demanding that there be changes made in the parole board, that it needs reform. So if you're talking about the issue of reform and the flaws in the parole board, then why not start with the case of the Move 9? Men and women who have been unjustly and wrongly denied their right to parole. Not just the Move 9, but several other men and women across the state of Pennsylvania who can contribute to society was being held back, denied parole based upon profits and prison labor. Because, oh, yes, these private institutions and corporations that have money invested in prisons, they're giving kickbacks to the parole boards to keep bodies in prison for labor, for production, for money.
There's also a petition up on the move9parole.blogspot.com, right?
Yes. People who go to move9paroleblogspot.com. There's an active petition up right now where we're urging people to sign this petition that we have aimed at Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney General, to get the Justice Department to open up an investigation into the case of the Move 9. Our goal is to get 25,000 signatures. So we need people to go to move9paroleblogspot.com and sign the petition at hand so that, you know, we can work to try to get the Justice Department to open an investigation into the case of the Move 9. I mean, we're not asking, we're not holding their hands or begging, but the public, we're putting a demand for them to investigate this case.
This is the Final Straw Radio on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. We're chatting with Ori Lumumba, a supporter of the Move 9, in their push to parole out three members of their group who have been in prison since 1978, collectively charged with the killing of a police officer, James Ramp, as the cops raided their house in Philadelphia. This despite the judge saying after the trial that he had no idea who actually killed Officer James Ramp, only that he wanted to send a message with the collective punishment of the MOVE members. MOVE is a religious and political organization coming out of the Black liberation struggle of the 1960s. It worships life and is based on the philosophies of John Africa. More on the case can be found at move9parole.blogspot.com. Next, Ori chats with us about the upcoming parole dates for Herman Bell, a former Black Panther and Black Liberation Army soldier who served along with Julian Montekin and now deceased Albert New Washington over 40 years for the death of two police officers in New York City in 1971.
In the spirit of God, in the spirit of the ancestors, in the spirit of the Black Panthers, in the spirit of Asada Shakur, we make this movement towards freedom for all those who have been oppressed and all those in the struggle. Yeah, yeah, check it. There were lights and sirens, gunshots frying. Cover your eyes as I describe a scene so violent. Seemed like a bad dream. She laid in the blood puddle, blood bubbled in her chest. Cold air brushed against open flesh, no room to rest. Pain consumed each breath, shot twice with her hands up. Police questioned, but shot before she answered. One Panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her. Comprehension, she was beyond trying to hold on to life. She thought she lived.
So you're also, to switch topics a little bit, Ori, you're also involved in the push to get Herman Bell paroled. Can you tell listeners a bit about Herman Bell?
Sure, definitely. Herman Bell is a former member of the Black Panther Party and a former soldier in the Black Liberation Army, and he's one of the longest held political prisoners in the U.S. prison system. Herman Bell originally went to prison, federal prison, in 1973 due to his actions in the Black Panther Party. Upon doing several years in federal prison, Herman was finally paroled, then brought to New York to stand trial for the murder of two New York City police officers that dates back to May of 1971. Herman originally started his New York State sentence in 1979. Upon coming here, his co-defendants, Albert Noah Washington, the late Albert Noah Washington, and Jahlil Abdul Muntakim, had already started serving their New York State prison sentences of 25 years to life. Now, Herman's been in the New York State prison system for his actions in the Black Liberation Army since 1979. Anyone and everyone in and out of the New York State prison system, senior or young, have come across and known Herman Bell. Herman either coached their football team, coached their basketball team in prison, taught them how to read, stirred them from gang violence, or just been a father figure to many men across the New York State prison system. So his accomplishments, he's earned several degrees in prison. He's founded what's called the Victory Gardens Project, where through friends in Maine who have a farm, they managed to put together produce for many communities, poor communities, where people got fresh, organic vegetables in their communities, and he's done this for years from inside the prison, you know. In 2003, Herman finally became eligible after serving his minimum sentence of 25 years. He became eligible for parole. Since 2003, every 2 years up until 2014, Herman has been denied by the New York State Parole Board for a period of 6 times now. 6 times Herman has been denied before the New York State Parole Board. Not because he doesn't have a home plan. He has a home plan established. Not because he doesn't have employment. He has he already has employment established, and it's been proven that he can contribute to society and the community as a whole. Herman has been held hostage by the New York State Parole Board since 2003 due to the influence of the New York City Patrolmen's Benevolent Association and the Fraternal Order of Police.
For anyone who's not, just really briefly, for anyone who's not really familiar with some of the bases for parole, when you say a home plan and employment, you're talking about post-incarceration, right? So ways to integrate, ways to like get back into the flow of life, and things that will keep one from falling back into like recidivism, right? Is that what you're referring to? Okay. And for anyone, like, I grew up on the West Coast, so I mean, I've become familiar with the Fraternal Order of Police and the Benevolent Association from having conversations about topics such as this. But for listeners that don't know about those institutions, can you say what they are, what their political leanings are, and what kind of influence they have?
The Patrolmen's Benevolent Association is a police union in New York headed by Patrick Lynch and several other policemen. And the goal is that the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, I guess, is a union, just like any other, to support their workers, show support. Now, the Fraternal Order of Police is a political body, like a political organization of cops, you know, who seem to have influence across the country over so many things. Or more so, they sway or influence decisions through their bully tactics. You know, people more so widely know the Fraternal Order of Police as the group that has lobbied to have Mumia Abu-Jamal executed for 3 decades, or who have lobbied and used their influence over state courts in New Jersey to further keep Sundiata Okoli in prison, despite the fact that there's a court order over a year now demanding that Sundiata be paroled from the New Jersey state courts. You know, they won't stop at nothing. Like, you saw a school teacher in New Jersey who had her students write get well cards to Mumia. The Fraternal Order of Police had her suspended and fired. You know, they're having movie theaters closed down when they show a movie about Mumia, or an art show put together by political prisoner Tom Manning. They're having art shows stopped and shut down. You know, the PBA, through the influence of the media, is painting the picture of Herman as a common criminal in the eyes of the media. But what about this cop that murdered Kai Gurley? Or the murderers of Sandra Bland? You know, or the murder of Eleanor Bumpers or Tamir Rice? Why aren't they being criminalized or publicized as criminals? You know, but Herman is being painted as a common criminal. You know, I think it's criminal when a man is shot 41 times in his doorway, you know, and the cop that killed him is being given a promotion, you know. Or here, a cop runs up in Romali Graham's house, who's proven hasn't done nothing, and runs in this young man's bathroom and shoots him and gets a raise. That is criminal.
For those who don't know, the reference to the 41 police bullets is to Amadou Diallo, who was an African immigrant in the 90s who died, was murdered by the hands of undercover police who jumped out of an unmarked vehicle and shot him as he was reaching for his wallet in his own front foyer, right?
Yes, sir.
So people, non-activists especially, like to periodize history in order to cap struggles and repressions as if they weren't a part of a larger continuum, like put them within these little boxes, and you could say this was civil rights, this was like, you know, the like feminist struggle and movement, this was gay liberation, whatever, like they want to put that within a little box. For anyone listening to this conversation we're having, Ori, can you compare the struggle against police murder and racist repression that was going on during the time of the post-civil rights movement era, i.e. the time of liberation struggles, to the current circumstances and struggles around similar, if not the same, repressions and murders of people of color by unindictable white police officers, majority white police officers?
It's the same, but it's just intensified even more. they're more blatant with it now, more out in the public, more out in the open. And they're being backed up and endorsed by the system's officials. So things haven't gotten better. They've gotten worse, and they're going to continue to get worse until people stand up and organize and take a stand against this thing. And that's the bottom line. But in regards to that, the similarities, it's the same. The outright murder of our children by police, and they're being protected by the system's officials. They're just more blatant, more out in the open with it now and stuff. Because they know they can get away with it fully. And that's the danger in this now. So it's all the same, but it's just intensified fully. We got serious work to do.
And in terms of the work that Herman Bell was doing before and even during his incarceration, can you talk about what sort of context? You mentioned that he was involved in the Black Panther Party. You mentioned that he was involved, he's a soldier in the Black Liberation Army. What, just really briefly, can you talk about what sparked those groups and what you know of his intentions of getting involved in those struggles? What he was trying to stop or fighting for?
The racist repression in our communities. Like, you could take a look. The Black Panther Party in 1966 started as a rifle club in the community by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, set to defend the community against the brutality and attacks by police. The same issues back then where young men was being beaten, nightsticks cracked over their heads, teeth being kicked out their mouth by police, unarmed men and women being shot dead in the police, in the street by the police. And this is what caused people to get up and to take a stand against this. You know, the same conditions that we see out here today, because this ain't nothing new. It goes back then and further to the inception of this system. So this is what caused people like Herman Bell to join the Black Panther Party or to later become soldiers in the Black Liberation Army and to defend the community on an arms front. So it's not that, you know, the media will label the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army as criminals. I don't think that. I think the criminal is this system. People will misinterpret things, but if you're getting up taking a stand against something, obviously the thing that you're taking a stand against isn't right, and that's why you're taking a stand against it. So we should never let this system or the media criminalize our freedom fighters as criminals, when the biggest criminal is this system, which forced people to get up and take a stand.
So you've mentioned that Herman Bell is one of the longest standing political prisoners within the United States. Can you talk about the circumstances of his incarceration and under what conditions he's been held?
Well, for the 29 years in New York State where he's been held, Herman has been in all of the maximum security prisons, Attica, and now back again in Great Meadows Correctional Facility in Comstock, New York. He's been in Sullivan Correctional Facility, Auburn Correctional Facility, Clinton Correctional Facility, all of the maximum joints he's been in. And if you see Herman, Herman's one of the most easiest going, one of the most nicest people, and they put him in these maximum security joints like he's some hardened criminal and stuff, you know. And he's been resilient through all of this. He's shown great resiliency and still has an amazing human spirit that wants to see a better world, that's pushing for this to be a better world. Now, the circumstances of his case, it revolves around the murder of a New York City police officer, which I really don't want to get into the specifics of his case and stuff, but the bottom line is this. Herman, like many others, they got up and they took a stand against this system when a stand needed to be taken against this system. Herman has done his time. He's been a model inmate. And it's time for them to let Herman go. And that's it. They need to parole Herman and stuff. And that's up to us, the people. The Patrolmen's Benevolent Association has kept their hand and worked in conjunction with the State Parole Board to make sure Herman doesn't come home. under the most questionable circumstances. And we got to fight to bring our brother home and take a stand against the PBA. There's nothing to fear. All we have to lose is our chains.
And outside of him, you know, fulfilling his responsibilities to the state for what he was accused of and convicted of, and outside of him having such a large impact outside of his cellmates, like meeting people, helping to build institutions, community gardens, sharing information and knowledge, mentoring people. He's got a family on the outside too, right?
Yeah, he has a beautiful wife, beautiful son, beautiful grandkids, everything that all want him to come home, you know?
All the more reason to think that he's going to be invested in his family and that it's time to give his grandkids their grandfather back.
That's right. Now, other than just having grandpa for a couple of hours in a visiting room, in a crowded visiting room.
How can folks on the outside find out more about Herman Bell's case, and how can they help to press the parole board to free Herman Bell?
People can go to the website, and it's www.freehermanbell.org. And they can go there. We currently have a petition on the website now in which we need 1,000 signatures. Just check in before the show. I believe we were up to 756 signatures. So we're almost at our goal of 1,000. So we're definitely asking people, they're listening to this show, go to www.freehermanbell.org and definitely sign the petition to help bring our brother Herman home. That's one of the first steps, this online petition that we have. Also, there's information where people can write letters of support for Herman, which is on the website as well, and where they can send letters to. But at this point, like, new things are being initiated for Herman, and we have the support of his family on the West Coast, his supporters here on the East Coast. So the best way for people to get involved in helping Herman, again, is to go to the website at www.freehermanbell.org.
And now I'd like to return, if you don't mind, to something that you mentioned before, actually a couple times throughout the conversation, which is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Is that cool?
Definitely.
All right. Mr. Lumumba, you also work with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I know we've covered a lot of information this hour, but it seems fitting to talk about Mumia since we've been speaking about the Black Panthers and the MOVE organization. Can you briefly tell the listeners about who Mumia is?
Mumia Abu-Jamal is another United States political prisoner. Mumia, former member of the Black Panther Party, a longtime supporter of the MOVE organization. Mumia Abu-Jamal was a journalist, a revolutionary journalist, who in the 70s gained the name of the voice of the voiceless, meaning that he gained a reputation for speaking up for oppressed people that couldn't speak up for themselves. As a journalist, you know, he did radio shows on police brutality, against unemployment, against so many different things. And this made Mumia a target of the Philadelphia police in the very late 70s, early 80s. In fact, when the MOVE 9 was arrested on August 8, 1978, and there was a press conference at City Hall, then Mayor Frank Rizzo, that day at the press conference, threatened Mumia. He singled Mumia out and threatened him, stating that he's going to see to it that one day Mumia pays for his brand of journalism. And they attempted that on December 9, 1981, this government made its first attempt on the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal, with Philadelphia police shot Mumia and almost killed him December 9, 1981. In their failure to kill Mumia, another officer, Daniel Faulkner, was killed, and Mumia was charged and convicted and given a death penalty for the murder of Officer Daniel Faulkner, despite the fact that there was clear evidence showing that Mumia didn't have a fair trial, also showing that he was innocent. On July 4th weekend, 1982, Mumia was sentenced to death. Momia spent about 30 years or more, or about 31 years on death row in the state of Pennsylvania. He's published several books from death row. In August of 95, this government attempted to kill Momia yet again when they tried to sign a death warrant to have him executed through lethal injection. They failed due to the power and the public, power of the public and the people. Again, this government attempted to murder Momia in 99 through lethal injection. And again, it was the power of the people that saved Momia's life. Due to the overwhelming pressure, this system had to eventually take our brother Momia off of death row in 2011, 2012, and we sentenced him to life without parole. This was due to the overwhelming amount of worldwide pressure that was put on this government about Momia. But that wasn't enough. When Momia was taken off of death row, the then widow of police officer Daniel Faulkner said, Momia is going to pay. Now that he's leaving death row, he doesn't have the luxuries afforded to him. He's going to be amongst his people, the murderers, the rapists, and the thieves in general population. And they're going to see to it that he pays for this. You know, so for over 30 years, Momia from death row, from prison, has stayed committed to putting out the truth, doing what a journalist is supposed to do, report the truth truthfully.
And Mumia's been, more recently since he's been back in general population, and just over this last year, he's been suffering from a number of medical issues that supporters of Mumia have said, and Mumia's own voice, have said he has not been getting proper treatment for. Can you talk about this?
Definitely. As I stated, the three attempts on Mumia's life by this government all failed. And now this government has made its fourth attempt on the life of Momia, this time to kill Momia through medical neglect. When Momia came off of death row in 2011, 2012, he was examined by the prison physician. And prison officials right then detected that Momia had hepatitis C, and they said nothing. Momia got hepatitis C December 9th, 1981, when he was shot by Philadelphia police. He had to receive like a blood transfusion while in the emergency room being operated on. And somehow through that, he contracted hepatitis C, which he kept for years. This past year, you know, 2015, Momia was having like a skin condition where his skin was always itching to the point where he broke out into like a full rash. Like a full body rash. Every part of his body was covered in a rash. And it was like a real painful rash. When you go on a visit with Momia, he would fall asleep on a visit because he would be so tired, like from not sleeping at night because of the painfulness of the skin condition.
Was it like a psoriasis?
Yeah, it was like a psoriasis. It was like an eczema type thing to the point where he would scratch it so bad to where his skin would start bleeding. So it got to the point where another brother up there, Major Tillery, saw Momia and said, man, Momia, you don't look good at all. You need to go to the infirmary, you know. And Momia went. And now this is viewed as eczema. The prison doctor gave Momia a steroid for eczema. Since when does someone get steroids for eczema, a skin rash or a skin condition? Which then caused Momia to stay in the infirmary. Momia was very weak. He's having several issues. At one point, he went to the bathroom, and he passed out in the bathroom. They had to take Momia to an outside hospital where he went into diabetic shock. And we're talking about diabetes. There was something happened with the medication that they gave Momia, this steroid, which then raised his blood sugars and caused him to get diabetes. Diabetes. So it's been a long uphill battle these past couple of months. Like, Momia was taken to an outside hospital twice where he still has his skin condition that's getting better to the point where he was finally diagnosed with the hepatitis C, which explains the skin condition, the rash, everything. And prison officials have refused to treat Mumia for the hepatitis C, saying that he's not sick enough. Yet he's been in infirmary for just about all of this year. He's been taken to the outside hospital twice, has gone into diabetic shock, has this skin condition. And they said he's not sick enough yet to be treated for this. So recently, Mumia's attorneys filed a suit in the courts for Mumia and other men and women across the state of Pennsylvania to be treated for the hepatitis C to get the medication. So what started last week, December 18th, was a court hearing in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where the attorneys argued for the right for men and women across the state of Pennsylvania to receive this new hepatitis C treatment, which has a 90% cure rate that they're refusing to give because they don't want to spend the money or cut costs, you know. And what we found out in yesterday, the third day of the court hearing, is that the lawyer for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections was falsifying documents in the court to try to cover the Pennsylvania's Department of Corrections and their mishandling of Mumia and the whole medical situation with this matter. And the point I want to make is we have to be on our toes and observant and stay on this issue. This government has not let up in their fight to kill Mumia, and they're using this issue with the hepatitis C and the medical neglect to execute Mumia. And it's up to us to stop this. The issue of medical neglect runs rampant in the United States prison system, especially as it relates to our political prisoners. Robert Seth Hayes in New York State is suffering from medical neglect now. Albert Noah Washington died from medical neglect in New York State prison, as did Kawazi Balgoon, as did Teddy Jahid, Bashir Hamid, Richard Williams on the West Coast in the federal prison system. This government has not let up in its fight to kill Mumia, and it's up to us to stop it. This is no different than December 9th, 1981, August 1995, or October of 1999. Just how we saw the urgency and fought back then, we have to apply that same urgency now to save the life of our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And especially considering the fact, I mean, the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal is definitely worth fighting for, but put within the context also of the fact that there's 10,000 other Pennsylvania prisoners infected with Hep C, it's not like they may be pinpointing against Mumia, but this is a massive problem that the supposed Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, you know, or Department of Corrections for Pennsylvania doesn't care enough about its, like, the people that it's supposed to be taking care of to rehabilitate and release back into the public, that they'd rather have them die of this long-term and painful disease. So
yeah, they would.
The fact that Mumia is standing up there and saying, like, yeah, okay, this is me, this is not only me, this is so many of us, I think is a really, like, upstanding and amazing thing, and allows us to draw a connection between supporting people who are in there for their political statements and actions and reporting in Mumia's case, as well as his activities in the Panther Party beforehand, but also connecting that with issues of mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex within the United States.
Definitely, definitely, because like I said, Mumia never speaks out about himself. He always speaks for all other men and women out there being oppressed. That's why so many men and women that's named in this suit as well, around the issue of the hepatitis C treatment, you know? And unfortunately, some people, they can't speak up for themselves or not willing to. And that's why Mumia got the name, the voice of the voiceless, you know? And yeah, this show, because the issue of hepatitis C in the United States prison system overall is a huge issue. Hep C has run rampant in the United States prison system for years. I remember when the late, great Safia Bakari wrote an article and spoke out about this in the very late 90s. Now, hepatitis C has just exploded across prisons in the United States.
It's incredible. Well, Ori, what's up next with this court case? How can people pay attention to as it proceeds, what's going on with it, and keep up on Mumia's health or get involved in sponsoring events for him or you know, keeping up to date and keeping active around Mumia's case?
Definitely. People can go to www.freemumia.com. They can go there for more information on what's going on with the court hearings and the current information with Mumia and what they can do and stuff. Again, they can go to www.freemumia.com.
Mumia in the past has also become known, even after his time, like after his imprisonment, for us younger folks who weren't in the Philly area and didn't get to hear his reporting at the time. Like he's been involved with Noel Hanrahan's amazing radio project, Prison Radio, which gets sampled by numerous radio stations and shows around the country. Democracy Now! Airs it occasionally. I know Flashpoints out of KPFA was airing it for a while. But that sits online along with the commentaries of numerous other political prisoners and commentators at like on Prison Radio's website. I was just about to look up what the website is. Mumia has also written a number of books, writes commentaries and articles on a regular basis, and is just an amazing, well-honed journalist. And if nothing else, people should definitely check out his past writings. I think articles and such are available at freemumia.com, right?
Yes, indeed. They could go to prisonradio.org, or they could go to www.freemumia.com.
Ori, is there anything else you wanted to talk about while we're on here?
I'm good at this point. We just want to send a message to people, you know, to keep fighting. Don't ever give up your fight against this system. And just want to thank you as well, Brother Burst, for having me on here to continue to put out the information about this parole situation, everything for Herman, for the MOVE sisters, and for everyone. It's greatly appreciated.
Ori, I definitely appreciate the work that you and your friends and family are doing as well. Same struggle. I wish you solidarity and health.
And send your revolutionary solidarity to you too, brother.
We've been speaking with Ori Lumumba about the upcoming paroles for three women of the MOVE 9 and for Herman Bell, former Panther and Black Liberation Army member. Check out our blog at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org for links on their cases. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, and Berkeley Liberation Radio in Berkeley, California. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with anything you want. And you can send us snail mail at thefinalstraw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.